pleasure to be here. It's my first time at Perimeter. It's not my first time in Canada, so I just wanted to say something about the two cities, San Diego and Toronto, two beautiful cities. our mayor, Bob Filner, had to resign in disgrace over sexual harassment allegations, and he had an excuse, which was that most people don't understand California's sexual harassment laws. Now, your guy, I got to say, you come from the United States, if you ever make the mistake of turning on Fox News, you sort of get inculcated in this sort of notion of American exceptionalism that no country could possibly do anything better than the U.S., especially political, corruption. But I got to admit, okay, so... anyway, finally, joke. I mean, if you're bored by this, you can play this seminar bingo, which is it's a fun game. You could distribute these during the seminars, and then anyway. Okay, so I want to talk about the amplitude mode in condensed matter in cold atom systems. So you could think of this as Higgs hunting on a budget. So I'll tell you the nebulous tie-in to the Higgs. I just used the word Higgs to try to draw more people to the talk. But here is the team in monotonic order. this is Snir Gazit, who's a postdoc, an excellent, a graduate student. He's applying for postdocs. I think he's applying here. He's outstanding. He's one of Asa Auerbach's students. Here's Asa. Here's Daniel Podolsky, and here's me. And here are some various images I got off of Google Images. Okay. The story starts with spontaneous symmetry breaking, which is a theme that's familiar to all of us in physics. The sort of model I'm going to be talking about here is just one where we have some n component real scalar field components phi 1 through phi n, and there's some sort of vanilla type action. Which looks like this. The interesting parts here are the potential and this coupling G. Okay, and so we'll choose for the potential this so-called Mexican hat, which looks like this. But so the basic physics is that when G is small, remember we have to compute some partition function and we have to do some functional integral over phi. There are fluctuations. When g is very, very small, then any variations here about the minimum are amplified by 1 over g, and that forces phi to sit at a local minimum over here. Whereas, so the average of phi is equal to 0, and we can think of some sort of like effective potential as looking like this Mexican hat, whereas for g large, basically the fluctuations overwhelm this tendency to order, and we're sitting over in expectation of phi is equal to 0. Okay. Incidentally, here's a photograph of me actually wearing a Mexican hat when I was in college. So, collective excitations in the broken and unbroken phases. So, in this broken phase, I should start with the unbroken phase. You have this sloshing around the bottom. This is obviously gapped. It just looks like some sort of parabola. This will turn out to represent some charge gap in a Mott insulator. And at the mean field level, this goes to 0 as you approach the critical point as the square root of G minus GC. So now on the other side, there are two modes. There's one where you sort of slide around the bottom here. That's the Goldstone mode, and that's gapless. But then we also have this radial oscillation, and that is the amplitude mode, and sometimes called the Higgs when people are writing grant proposals. And so that looks the same. In fact, there at the mean field level, there's some ratio, definite ratio between the mass on this side versus on the other side. Goes the ratio is squared of 2. So this is basically the lay of the land in terms of these collective excitations in these two phases. There are two ways to parameterize the deviations from the ordered state. One, we could think of basically just Cartesian and polar coordinates. So in the Cartesian version of things, we say that we choose a direction. Say the first component will be the direction where we get a vacuum expectation value, and so let's just expand about the potential minimum here, and we have some fluctuation, and then we have these transverse fluctuations here as well, and longitudinal and transverse. If you write down the our original Lagrangian, that ON model Lagrangian, then in terms of these sigma and pi fields, it looks like this. We have some mass, M for the sigma field, and then the pi field, those are the Goldstone bosons that are massless, and then there's all this other junk over here, which comes in at higher order, which turns out to be very important. So another way of looking at it is in polar coordinates. So here we can parameterize it in terms of some radial field rho, and then some unit vector n hat. Not exactly the same as this. It's just again the difference between Cartesian and polar coordinates essentially. And here again, you have something which if you drop all the terms, go beyond the quadratic ones, it looks just like a Gaussian theory where you have some massive mode for this radial fluctuation and then the massless ones moving around the bottom. So what's dangerous here are these guys, for example. So this allows this longitudinal mode sigma to decay into two of these pi Goldstone bosons. And similarly here, we have rho times d mu n hat squared. So we can have a decay of this rho field. And so what that means is that the Higgs mode becomes unstable, so we have the following situation. We have this interaction part of our Lagrangian. Let's just look at these cubic terms. One in the Cartesian representation, it looks like sigma pi squared, and the polar, it's rho times the grad n squared. And what this means is that here's our amplitude mode. Analogous to the Higgs in the standard model, although this model, of course, has no gauge field here. I'll mention a little bit about that at the end. And because of these terms, Higgs can decay into two Goldstone modes. So that prompts the question: what is the lifetime of this excitation? So, you can compute this. You can compute the longitudinal response function here and find this self-energy. Now we know that in three space dimensions, so d plus 1 is equal to 4, this model at finite n has d plus 1 equals 4 as its upper critical dimension. And there's as g goes to gc, the critical coupling, the longitudinal mode actually becomes sharp. There's a beautiful paper by Affleck and Wellman from the 90s, which discusses this very clearly. But in d equals 2, it's more interesting. If you compute the self-energy just to lowest order in the coupling g, what you find is that it becomes infrared divergent. And if you analytically continue from the Euclidean result, you find that the lifetime, the imaginary part of the self-energy, diverges as 1 over omega, which would lead you to conclude that this mode is overdamped, and this has been noticed by many authors, going back quite some time. That would suggest that maybe we can't see this because of the decay to the Goldstone modes. I cite a great source, Subir. Sachdev, in his beautiful book on quantum phase transitions, remarks how the pole at the position of the Higgs energy. I also cite this to point out that Subir uses the word Higgs, so you might have detected in Will's introduction, this very subtle, dogma that we shouldn't be calling this the Higgs, but rather the amplitude mode, which I actually agree with him completely on in this model. It's conventional to call it the Higgs. So the Higgs energy, this pole's disappeared. We only get a branch cut having its onset at the spin wave energy. And for d less than 3 and n greater than 1, there is no Higgs particle, only a broad continuum of multiple spin wave excitations in the longitudinal response. This is an extremely kosher source. Here's the kosher seal of approval. many hechshers we give to anything severe, right? So, and as usual, it's absolutely correct. But I want to emphasize that in what he's saying here, the key word is longitudinal. Okay, and so and as I say, longitudinal. That's really the sigma field that we were talking about. So we could ask the same question about the lifetime of the Higgs, but now think about it in terms of this rho field, the purely radial field in the polar representation. So if you compute this, see, the thing is that rho couples to grad n squared rather than sigma going to pi squared. So you have two extra derivatives, and what that means is that when you compute the self-energy, it goes to zero as omega cubed, and all of a sudden you're led to think that the this amplitude mode is sharp, or should be visible. So this leads to a question, which is how can the sharpness of this Higgs mode depend on our parameterization of the degrees of freedom? And the answer is, well, it just does. I mean, the Cartesian and polar coordinates correspond to different correlation functions, and whether or not you see a sharp Higgs mode depends on the type of experiment that you perform. If you look here at these are some large N results. If you look at the longitudinal excitable prime for the sigma field, it goes like 1 over omega, and here for the rho field, you see a nice bump. Okay, can you resolve the bump is the question as you go to the critical point, I'll the rest of the talk I'm going to spend discussing that question. So I just want to mention, emphasize again, one thing to take away from here is this business of longitudinal versus scalar. So this longitudinal response, it's measured by an experiment where the probe couples directly to the order parameter field itself, something like this, H dot phi, like a magnetic field. This is linear response theory. Then gives phi is in general is chi times H. We have to compute this correlation function here. We would compute the correlation function of the where A equals B equals 1. This would correspond to what you would see if you would look at, let's say, neutron scattering in an antiferromagnet. And I'll show some results from some beautiful, relatively recent experiments in three dimensions for neutron scattering. The scalar response would be measured by an experiment which couples directly to the magnitude of the order parameter field here, something that looks like this. It couples to rho, and so now we're interested in this different correlation function. And examples where this is the correlation function you want are when you, for example, two magnon Raman scattering in antiferromagnetic insulators, or in the pump probe spectroscopy and charge density wave systems. There's this nice work going back many, many years on the effect of Raman Hamiltonian, where you're interested in these so-called Loudon-Elliott operators, which look like essentially S dot S on neighboring links, which are proportional to the order parameter squared. And so it's really coupled this here when you look at the these sorts of experiments, you're coupling to this not to the longitudinal field, but rather to what we call the scalar field, this radial oscillation. So, okay, what's the relation between them? Well, that's very easy. We write rho is phi squared over n minus 1, and phi we had that Cartesian parameterization, so we can write what this is, and we can see rho to lowest order is just proportional to sigma. But then to higher order, we get something proportional to sigma squared and pi squared. So what that means is that when you compute, you don't have to worry about the, the details here, but when you compute chi rho rho, it's equal to chi sigma sigma plus some other crap, and you know, part of that is singular, okay? Part of it is regular at low frequency, but part of it is singular. So the infrared behavior of chi rho rho is different from that of chi sigma sigma, okay? So anyway, I want to just mention some things about the large N theory. So the way we set things up at the beginning was amenable to a large N calculation where everything in the N goes to infinity limit, the free energy scales with N. So in that case, if you you have some controlled expansion in powers of 1 over N about the N goes to infinity limit. If you compute the renormalization of the order parameter, you get this sort of mean field result where phi is proportional to the square root of N but times some quantity which goes like the square root of 1 minus G over GC. So you have some critical coupling which depends on some ultraviolet cutoff you put in the theory, and then you get this sort of mean field behavior for the amplitude mode mass in the ordered phase, and then the charge gap in the disordered phase. You can ignore all that. You can compute chi sigma sigma and chi rho rho. So I just want to show you as we go from 84% of the way to the critical point, you're still seeing a nice bump in chi rho rho, whereas it's completely obscured in the longitudinal susceptibility. And then of course as we get deeper and deeper into the ordered phase, then these things become more and more alike, and you just see a nice peak. So why is it, again, the scalar measurements are sharper? So the scalar measurements are insensitive to the sort of random rotations of the order parameter that are the direction of the order parameter that caused by emission of spin waves. And so what this means is that the divergence in this longitudinal response is really due to the contamination of the longitudinal field with the spin waves, which we saw happens at sort of second order, and not intrinsically due to the decay of the Higgs itself. So if we want to think about the intrinsic decay of the amplitude mode, we should really be using rho and not sigma is the message. So so let's ask, what is the Higgs lifetime? The scalar measurements. So I'll just sort of take you through what happened the last few years historically. So one gains some intuition from this large N stuff, although really at the end of the day we want to do some more serious numerical work on finite N models, which I'll describe. But so this scalar peak is sharpest deep inside the ordered phase where G much less than GC. Close to the quantum critical point, it broadens. So we can investigate this as N goes to infinity, and you get this sort of behavior. You can see in three dimensions, this thing is the width is controlled all the way up to the critical point, and the decay is just controlled by the coupling. And in fact, as I said, for finite N, as you get to the critical point, the ratio of the width to the mass goes to zero as there's some logarithmic behavior there. It's more interesting in two space dimensions, and here this seems to be broadening out. But as you're getting fairly close to the critical point, you still see this peak. Okay, and so here I've plotted in the inset, the Higgs mass, versus its width, And so, as you go right to the get close enough to the critical point, the width gets bigger than the mass. But you're seeing this fairly close to GC. yeah. Yeah, well, I'm gonna mention a little bit about that. Yeah, it's not my work, but stuff that Daniel Podolsky and Sabir Sachdev did. So, so this large N actually is something that should at least start one thinking, and the so okay. Have I ever met you, sir? Yeah. It's because I have your watch. Yes. No. As Will was asking, what about the order 1 over n? So there's very nice work by Podolsky and Sachdev. So near GC, it turns out that the scalar response function satisfies some scaling relation, which looks like the following. This is not... The large N does not give you this nice scaling relation, and G minus GC, the dependence of the gap, the Higgs mass on G minus GC is not the mean field square root behavior, but in fact there's some this exponent, which is a little bit more than 2/3, if you look at what happens to this scaling function phi as a function of omega over the Higgs mass, then it does seem to have a peak at some finite value of omega. Omega over delta is some finite value, and that peak is shifting as you change n, and again, this is really only valid to order 1 over n. So again, this peak exists at a frequency omega, which is proportional to g minus gc to the nu. For n goes to infinity, this bump that we saw in the n goes to infinity, the large n calculation, lies at a parametrically larger value of the frequency, proportional to the square root. And so the n equals infinity results, on this scale will just sort of take off like this and won't show any peak at some finite value of omega over delta, So this is theory. I wanted to mention that. So one application of this physics is lattice boson models, where for example the Bose-Hubbard model. This would describe here some hopping bosons hopping in some local potential Vi with some on-site interaction U. for a small t over U, the system's a Mott insulator where the n is pinned to some integer values. For large t over U, it's a superfluid. So the phase diagram looks something like this. One has these famous Mott lobes over here, where the system is incompressible, and then here's the superfluid phase in blue. And far from these Mott lobes out here in the deep in the superfluid phase, the system is basically described by a Gross-Padayevsky model, where it's just first order in the time derivative. And so there you get a gapless Goldstone mode, but there is no Higgs, okay? the phase fluctuations and the amplitude are actually conjugate to each other. So they're, you know, basically describing the same excitation. Whereas when you get close to the tip of the Mott lobe, you have some emergent relativistic dynamics, and you know, both the Goldstone mode and the Higgs are present. So here I'm going to mention some experimental results in some cold atom systems, which are done close to this transition. So just wanted to emphasize that for these lattice boson systems, the issue of whether or not you really are talking about a model that has these relativistic dynamics, which is what we started with, is really really depends on where you are sitting in this phase diagram, and it's really only true in the vicinity of this of these quantum critical points. I wanted to mention a couple of things about experiments before I talk about numerics. There's some work on optical lattices. About 10 years ago, there's some work on looking at starting to modulate the depth of 3D optical lattices. A lot of this early work was very far from the linear regime. There were claims that they saw something like this amplitude mode, but typically these results were involved very nonlinear response at large wave vector. The most impressive results were the recent work coming out of Emmanuel Bloch's group, and this was published last year, and there was a nice session on this March meeting this year. the basic idea is that you have they're taking some lattice and periodically modulating the lattice depth, as you see here. And there's some sort of protocol here in time. So what they do is they sort of ramp up the lattice depth. And then you have your bosonic system sitting in this lattice, and now they sort of shake it up, and so you want to know what energy have you coupled energy into this system, and to measure that what they do is they then sort of adiabatically ramp up the lattice depth again, so that essentially all the particles are, don't hop from one site to the other, and then they can sort of locally measure the temperature by looking at just the what's happening in a single well. So but they can then see when they modulate the amplitude the depth of this potential, which is really coupling to the square of the order parameter. How this couples to the system as a function of the frequency of this oscillation, and so when they look for where these resonances are, they see this beautiful result where they can see this Mott to superfluid transition, and they see the Higgs mode here, and this is I emphasize a two-dimensional condensate, where if you were looking at let's say your neutron scattering in an antiferromagnet or something close to if at some quantum critical points, you'd really have no hope of seeing it, because you'd be looking at the longitudinal rather than this scalar response. So there's some this in some sense is observation of this amplitude mode for a two-dimensional system. I think the first time it's been observed in two dimensions. Okay, so numerical simulations. Let's just check on what time it is. When did I start?
3 minutes in.
What?
30 minutes
in. Okay. All right. So, Pollitt and Prokofiev looked at the Bose-Hubbard model, and looked at there's a superfluid insulator transition here. The first Mott lobe tip at U equals, almost 17 times J. J is the hopping. And so they can see as they crank up U to the critical point that there's this so they see initially some peak out here at largish omega over J, but then as they crank up U to the critical point, they see this very strong resonance at low frequencies. And that's really this amplitude mode. There was subsequent it was basically around the same time as some work on the discretized version of this relativistic ON model, which sees very similar results. This is work by Gazit, Auerbach, and Podolsky. Here, again, you can't see these numbers, but these are the percents, how close one's getting to the critical point in terms of percent, and this is getting down to within, let's say, 2% of the critical point. I'll show you some data for even closer. But here you see, some peak sitting out here at some larger frequency, which can tentatively identify as the peak that we see in the n equals infinity calculation, but then at some lower frequency, which would be parametrically lower as a function of the distance to the critical point, this is the amplitude mode resonance. So they're looking at different models. This is a Bose-Hubbard model. This is discretized version of the ON model. So this is sort of all symmetric between space and time, whereas this one really isn't. But they give very similar pictures for what's happening as one approaches the quantum critical point.
When you say ON, you say O2, or?
Yeah. This is for O2, but I'll show some results for O3 and as well. These Monte Carlo calculations, are done on this lattice model, as I was mentioning. It's very simple. You just have the dot product of phi on neighboring sites, and then a quadratic and a quartic term. And so this is studied with the Worm algorithm. This is a marvelous numerical advance for bosonic systems by Prokofiev and Svistonov. And so you can convert this to some loop model, which is dual to the original model with these phi variables, and so we study here system sizes of order 200. Okay, so that's the linear dimension 200. So for d equals 2, this is then 200 cubed sites, and so want to keep the correlation length to be smaller than 200. So typically they're looking at systems getting to within a distance of the correlation, the critical point, where the correlation is getting up to about some tens of lattice spacings. And then there's a rather dirty business here, which involves when you're extracting frequency data that depends on real frequency to numerically do some analytical continuation from Matsubara frequencies to real frequencies. So here's what it looks like when you track this Higgs peak. Here's n equals 2. Here's n equals 3. So you can see how the behavior here as a function of the where the peak value is for chi double prime as a function of omega, and that basically serves as a proxy for the Higgs mass here. So one can do that for different n. And here one's getting to within a quarter of a percent of the critical point. So what happens in two dimensions? Here's n equals 2 and n equals 3, lying on top of each other. So again, for g less than g critical, this is in the ordered phase. Here's your Higgs mass crashing down to zero. And then here you have a real gap. You're in the disordered phase, the quantum disordered phase. So there is some, as you can see, the mean field predicted there was some ratio between these on the order of the square root of 2. Numerics gives some slightly different value. There is a universal spectral function for the amplitude mode here, and this obeys this scaling form that I mentioned earlier. And you can see here results for n equals 2 and n equals 3. And again, these are the, as you get closer and closer to the critical point, and the blue is the closest in both cases. This thing does have some width, but it you can clearly make out the peak. So the conclusion is that this Higgs mode, while it's not absolutely sharp, it's a resonance which survives down close to criticality, even in two dimensions. The prediction from numerics is that this ratio is about 2.1. There are other predictions in the literature, the ratio here. This actually, I think, was from one of these not from the discretized relativistic ON model, but for the bosonic Hubbard. I'm inclined to put a little bit more trust in this, but I guess there's still some issue as to what this universal ratio is. So I wanted to mention something about conductivity. So this peak, the Higgs peak, can be seen in the optical conductivity of charged bosons. It's also relevant to cold atom experiments in some fluctuating optical lattice. This is discussed in this work of Takuno and Giumarchi. The goal here is some controlled evaluation of the optical conductivity in the vicinity of this quantum critical point. So let me just mention a few things about the general formalism for ON conductivity. So for n equals 2, we can parameterize our order parameter field as having these two components, some amplitude, and then some unit vector. And then the current is just proportional to the gradient of this angle times this amplitude. So what happens in the ON case? So you can start by gauging this Lagrangian for the ON model, now A, the vector potential is some becomes actually some anti-symmetric tensor, and that's expanded in terms of the ON generators, and you can then define these ON currents as variations of the action with respect to these the components of those generators. There's still some notion of gauge invariance and also a Kubo formula that we're used to in condensed matter physics, and we can compute an electromagnetic response tensor, and as in the usual case, this breaks up into a paramagnetic and a diamagnetic contribution. So, in the symmetric phase, this response tensor is is diagonal in these indices A and B, which refer to the ON generators. But in the broken phase, there are two classes of generators you have to distinguish, broken and unbroken. And so we'll call these class B and U. So the broken generators rotate between the phi 1, which is the direction in which the symmetry is broken, and these other guys. And so there are n minus 1 of those. And then the unbroken generators rotate between the different directions of the Goldstone mode. So generalizing from the n equals 2 case, what we're really interested in, and there we only have this class B. So we're really interested in this guy, the BB response function. So we can compute that, there's a delta function contribution in the ordered phase, which would correspond to, let's say, a superfluid, and then some contribution at finite frequency, we can compute this finite frequency part by computing some nasty correlation function. There are just a couple of diagrams to compute. And at the end of the day, when you do this, you find to lowest order in the coupling that what this looks like is the following. There's you got our delta function peak at zero frequency, and then there's a gap. This is the Higgs gap, and then the optical conductivity turns on from there, and it depends when you're in two or three dimensions. Okay. Again, this is a perturbative. What happens if we go to higher order? So in that case, we know that the system is really gapless. There are Goldstone modes, so there will be something filling in that gap. And if you go to order G and you compute a couple more diagrams, then what one finds is the following, that this finite frequency contribution, if you compute the sub-threshold contributions, you have this expansion in powers of the frequency, which in two dimensions starts with omega, omega cubed, and omega to the fifth, and in three with omega cubed, omega to the fifth, and omega to the seventh. Remarkably, when n equals 2, the first two contributions, these lowest order contributions in powers of the frequency, vanish. And so what that gives rise to is a very pronounced pseudo gap, at least at the order G in this calculation. So it would be interesting to know what happens as we go increase G toward G critical. But this is showing a clear difference, for example, at the perturbative level between n equals 2 and n equals 3. So you might ask, why is n equals 2 so special in this regard? And the current operator, which is for n equals 2 proportional to grad phi, is itself O2 symmetric and doesn't depend on the direction in which this symmetry is broken, which turns out to be the case. This is not the case, I should say, then for n greater than 2. So the what that means is the Goldstone modes couple more weakly in n equals 2, which is similar to what we found from the scalar susceptibility calculation.
What about the proliferation of vertices in n equals 2?
Well, yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure. The perturbative results, you can just take them at face value. I don't know if we can extract any information about what vortices are doing from that. But as you go to the critical point, all we can really do is do it numerically, and we haven't tried to disentangle what's happening with the vortices. Work of that's in press now, this is for the conductivity of the O2 model. So one can compute, you can find where the this just shows you how numerically you can find the location of the critical point by looking at the scaling of the helicity modulus of this system. And when you compute the dynamical conductivity, so here's on the ordered and the disordered side, these colored curves are the numerical data. Now again, it's wiggling around here, and this is because one has to do this aforementioned rather unpleasant analytical continuation, which where there are actually several ways to do it, none of them particularly reliable. And this black curve is an actual theoretical result, you know, from the that I just discussed from the perturbative result, and here's here's some result for the Mott insulator on the Mott side. So this is the theoretical work is from Subirin collaborators, so you know, here's a comparing here our Monte Carlo data on this side. So here there's a real gap, okay, where here again there was this, you know, the perturbative calculation suggested there was for n equals 2 there was this very strong pseudo gap, but beyond that, as we get closer to the critical point over here, we really don't quite know what to expect. It's hard to really extract the numerical results in this region, but it certainly seems that things come crashing down to zero right at omega is equal to delta. One can also try to estimate going to higher frequencies what the limiting value is, we have some estimates, even though it's obviously a bit dicey estimating from these fluctuating curves, but there is an estimate which is consistent with other work that's been done recently. There's some beautiful work that Will has been involved with, and also the Prokofiev and collaborators as well. So there is some universal, value here, which we estimate this number and is roughly consistent with what other groups are finding. I wanted to just mention a few things about experiments and then conclude. How much time is there? Five. Okay. Well, let me just race through this. Okay. So phasons and the amplitude modes are observed in pump probe spectroscopy in these one-dimensional CDW systems. So you can think of the sort of phason and amplitude mode pictorially in this way. One sees is typically these two peaks which can be tracked as a function of wave number, and so the claim is that they can see both this sort of phonon mode as well as this amplitude mode in these CDW systems. Here's another experiment in terbium tritelluride. Here, what they do is they have this is Yusupov and all his data. They take the system. They have this destruction pulse. So they have a CDW phase. The destruction pulse is where they just blast the shit out of it. And then then what happens is they destroy the order, and they watch the order coming back. As this happens, so the basic idea with this pump probe stuff, right, is that you have your CDW sitting there. You pump it, okay, and then you're exciting your amplitude mode and also various phonon, like the Goldstone modes, and then you probe it later on as a function of that the time difference between the pump and the probe. You can, if you take that result in Fourier transform it, you can say something about the the excitation spectrum. So here you can see that this time after the quench here, well, so this is the distance between the destruction pulse and then this pump. You know, you can see the amplitude mode coming back. Here's this neutron scattering in the antiferromagnet that I mentioned. So this was also presented in this Higgs session at the March meeting this year by Christian Ruegg. And so here, this thallium copper chloride, this is a three-dimensional system. They're computing, again, this longitudinal susceptibility. As a function of pressure, there's a quantum phase transition where you go from this dimer phase to like an AL antiferromagnet. And so you can see this dimer phase, which corresponds to the quantum disordered phase in the ON models I was talking about, how the gap is crashing to zero. Here, you'll notice there are two different excitations that are tracked, and that's, you know, because in these systems there is typically some single ion anisotropy, which is gives rise to two different frequencies. But here again, one can see this amplitude mode coming out quite clearly in the data. And then finally, this is an old story, and a bit, I don't want to step into this too much. And if you want to know about this, ask Bhaskaran, who's the local expert. In superconductors, actually, it turns out that you can't really see the amplitude mode. You need to sort of couple to the electron density in some way, rather than to the order parameter. The Higgs mode itself doesn't couple these charge fluctuations. So in order to see the Higgs, it's useful to have a system here where there's also a CDW order. So there's sort of a couple of things going on here: superconductivity and charge density wave order. And I guess just the simplest thing is just to look at these the results over here. This is Raman. So at some temperature down here of 9 Kelvin, where you have a CDW order but no superconducting order, then you just see these two peaks labeled I and C. And when you cool below the TC for the superconductor, which is around 7 Kelvin, then you see this new peak emerging. So there was a old paper, rather influential, by Littlewood and Varma, where they try to compute this from a BCS point of view. Anyway, I just wanted to remind people that the real Higgs mechanism is just a beautiful discussion in this old review article by Abers and Lee, where you have this gauged, relativistic, O2 theory, and then you rewrite the order parameter in terms of radial and angular fields. Lagrangian is gauge invariant. You can choose as your gauge function the phase of this order parameter, and redefine your gauge fields in this way, and what you then end up with is the situation where the photon now in 3 plus 1 dimensions becomes this massive triplet with some mass which depends on the charge. There is no Goldstone boson, which would be this psi fluctuation. It is the terminology the field theorists use. They say it's eaten by the photon field. And then the Higgs mass, that's our eta, that's independent of E with the M Higgs is 2M0. So the Higgs mass and then the vector boson mass are independent things. So we don't have this vector boson in what we have, which is why it's perfectly legitimate to object to anyone giving a talk on this using the word Higgs, and why I vacillate between the Higgs and amplitude mode. So, all right, I'll skip this because I think I'm running out of time. I was going to talk about a little bit of that time-dependent Ginzburg-Landau theory, but let me just go to summarize. ON model, the two different phases, the broken and the unbroken. Here's the collective excitations in those phases. The radial excitation here, this Higgs, can decay into Goldstone bosons. The scalar response, chi rho rho, is sharper than the longitudinal response. There is a lot of compelling result. So this is sort of like some large N result, but now there is very compelling work from theory doing order 1 over N calculations, scaling numerical simulations, which sort of partially confirms but clarifies and extends this picture greatly. So we can see the collapse of the Higgs and the charge gap, get these universal spectral functions, talk about the ratio, this universal ratio of those gaps. The conductivity, which is a physical quantity from perturbative calculations, has a very pronounced pseudo gap for n equals 2, and has recently been the subject of various numerical investigations. And there's a universal high frequency result, which seems to various investigators seem to be converging on the value. And finally, there are experiments in several different venues. There are charged density waves, there are cold atomic gases, there are anti-ferromagnets, and more, where this amplitude mode physics is seen. So let's. I want to just conclude with some open questions. So one, which is actually something Will asked me at dinner last night, which the perturbative results found this pronounced pseudo gap in the conductivity for n equals 2. There was a real qualitative difference between n equals 2 and n greater than 2. So is the low frequency conductivity qualitatively different at finite g when you go beyond perturbation theory? There's nothing in our numerical results we can really hang our hat on to distinguish. It looks like there's a pretty strong pseudo gap for n equals 2, but we haven't actually investigated the n equals 3 down there yet, so that's something to do. Theories of deconfined quantum criticality, which you've probably heard quite a bit about already, they're described by an action, sort of non-compact CP1 or CPN, if you generalize it, action, where you have a real gauge field, like in that Abers and Lee discussion. So it's a dynamical gauge field. So you have the full-fledged Higgs mechanism. So in the Nail phase, you have spin waves, you have a Higgs, and you have massive vector bosons. And there's some very beautiful work coming out of Sabir and collaborators recently looking at these, computing the response functions for these guys, which involves some heroic calculations. So whether or not, though, the Higgs can decay to massive vector bosons depends on this charge. As I was saying before, the Higgs and the vector boson mass are really independent parameters. So so that this leaves open the question: is what is the fate of the Higgs near a deconfined quantum critical point? I may step in it at this point, but I it's my understanding that with the standard model Higgs sitting at about 125 GeV, that it's less massive than twice the vector boson masses. The W and the Zs come in at like 80 and 95. So that decay wouldn't. Am I correct about this? I'm looking at the resident field theory expert. That decay wouldn't go, but if the Higgs were much heavier, then presumably it would mostly decay to vector bosons, from what I understand. Another I think interesting question is that there's been a lot of interesting work recently on diluted antiferromagnets, There are differences between site dilution and dimer bond dilution. There's an interplay of geometric criticality and quantum fluctuations. There's like two transitions at weak dilution as a function of the coupling G. There's an ON transition, but when you have small g as a function of the dilution, there's a percolation transition, and there's a multicritical point at some PC and G star. So what's going on with the amplitude mode in these systems would be interesting. So finally, the search for the Higgs. Okay, well, thank you. Yeah, so.
Any questions?
In the case of ferromagnets.
Yeah.
The coastal modes are quadratic.
Yes.
How does it modify?
Well, the ferromagnets, it's really more that you have it's sort of like a linear time derivative action. So it's not this sort of like, I don't think you really can say that you have a an amplitude mode there. And it's like we were saying about the nonlinear Schrodinger equation. If you look in that case, that rho and phi are conjugate. So there is in the Gross-Panevsky model, there is no Higgs. Okay, there's just the phonon. Okay, so I think I don't think it's really applicable to the ferromagnets. Oh yeah, so that's so right. Okay, that's a good question. Yeah, so where is it? Blah, 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 blah. Yeah, so I mean, for example, if you do, there's very nice work by a number of people, von Otterlo and their collaborators in the '90s. They looked at what is the actual time-dependent form of the time-dependent Ginzburg-Landau theory for superconductor. So you go through this, protocol of, decoupling you have some vanilla S-wave superconductor, you decouple this attraction, integrate out the fermions, you find some effective action. when you do, you find that there is a linear time derivative term, okay? And typically, it's very small. It's proportional to the electron hole asymmetry. It's the logarithmic derivative of the density of states at the Fermi energy. So if you have if you have particle hole symmetry at the Fermi energy, this is zero. In fact, this is one reason why the fact that this is typically small is one reason why when people study vortex dynamics and superconductors, like when the pros like Charles Reichardt and Cynthia Reichardt Olsen study these beautiful dynamical phases of vortices, they could just assume that the vortices are pretty much completely overdamped. There's no sort of Hall angle that they have to worry about there, which incidentally is not true for recent work on magnetic skirmions. But at any rate, in this case, you should have for the, in general, this is what you would expect for this, Bose Hubbard. You'd have something between these guys, and then so you could try to. I mean, you sort of know qualitatively what's happening, but if you try to get a large N theory, for this, there's some problem we can discuss later. But I think you can only really say what's happening as you are approaching this critical point. I'm not sure, as you move off of this here, you should have to worry about this and so that will. That will introduce differences in the.
Coming off the line of the upper part of that, that's where you have a quadratic.
Yeah, over here. Yeah, I was talking about what happens as you cross over over here. And I'm so there, yeah, I'm just saying you have to worry about this you know, linear term, and it's not going to be this relativistic ON, you know, dynamics. That's all I know about it at this point, really. I don't know, Will, have you thought about that at all? Or? Yeah. So, you know, short answer is I don't know. I don't want to speculate. Yeah.
One of them was the superconductor plus CDW, right?
Yeah.
And so it was trying to measure the amplitude mode of the superconductor. In that case, it really should be like the Higgs mode coupled to the Higgs mode, the UCF, right?
Yeah. I mean, the right. So there,
the superconductor actually is Higgs.
Yeah. So, you know, there's an issue, I guess, of what the what the Higgs energy is, you know, relative to the superconducting gap, right? You know, if it's much bigger than 2 delta, then, you know, there's you know, lots of other stuff going on. So I think that these results that I showed are very sort of specific to it's weak coupling BCS, I don't know. Baskaran would probably be a better person to ask about that.
Close to 2 delta.
Yeah.
So that was the experiment. Because it's not there, your quantum critical point.
There. Yeah.
It's well defined in the superconducting state. They're basically probing it through charge density.
Yeah.
Just to prove the existence of
yeah.
a Higgs mode in superconducting.
Yeah. It was slightly just below 2 delta in that calculation.
That sounds like the first Higgs mode of the real, like, you know, okay, not electrically, but it was dynamical.
Well, that's what Chandra Varma will tell you, yeah, definitely.
That's where Anderson appeared.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So you didn't talk much about comparing the spectral function experiments.
No.
Especially frequency.
Yeah.
So the scope of measuring that, for example, in cold atoms.
I don't know what the status of that is. You know, in terms of, like, you know, actually looking at the width or something of the. Or the, you know, finding this universal, you know, form. Yeah. I don't recall I don't think I showed all the data from the Endres paper. I don't remember actually I don't think a detailed comparison has been done yet though.
Since you mentioned various examples, what about liquid helium 4?
Yeah. Well, again, helium 4, that's really Gross-Podievsky type dynamics.
Extreme.
Yeah, that you know, so I mean, it's, you know, it's
single-stone mode and
roton. Yeah, to really, I mean, the Gross-Podievsky itself won't have the roton, but, you know, you could sort of mock up some sort of interaction potential there, you know, to give some sort of roton, you know, which would be sort of wouldn't be, you know, perfectly local, But you could get a reproduce the roton as well. But again, the point is that it's non-relativistic dynamics. The rho and phi are conjugate. So whether or not there is or isn't a roton, that's an independent issue. But also it's not really a quantum critical point that you're thinking about there. Right?
There is one, not a first order constant, as a function of pressure.
You mean the crystallization? Yeah. Well, yeah, that's
also something constant.
That's a different story, yeah.
What is the weak first order?
Yeah. Yeah, again, that's crystallization is, that's not going to be the same transition we're talking about here.